Hello, WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM. This is Ruby Banerjee, and you're back on Tech Unfiltered. It's amazing to be back, and we will be talking about some more things. Some more that are kind of related to what we talked about last show. So last time we talked about how radar works, and also how its technology is helping essentially the world. But then now I kind of want to talk about in a broader aspect, like electricity and power grids and all that type of stuff. So when we think about technology, we usually think about what we can see. We think about smartphones lighting up in our hands. We think about laptops, social media feeds, streaming platforms, video calls, satellites, and maybe even artificial intelligence and processing data throughout the world. But what we rarely think about is how it works. None of it works without cables. In fact, me right now sitting in the studio, there is so many things around me. Like, there is an endless amount of cables. And so it's a lot. And none of this would work without it. And not wireless signals floating magically through the air and satellites doing all those heavy lifting. Cables. Physical glass, hair-thin strands of fiber optic cables buried under cities, threaded through buildings, running beneath highways, and most astonishingly, stretching across the ocean floor. The modern weight is not weightless, it's not abstract, it's not simply the cloud, it's infrastructure. And that infrastructure is one of the greatest engineering achievements of the modern era. Tonight, we're talking about the hidden architecture of the internet, how fiber optics and submarine cables support nearly every aspect of our now modern life. Because even though while we scroll, stream, and send messages instantly, the physical systems carrying those signals remain largely invisible. And yet, they shape global economics, politics, communication, and even power itself. So let's start with something simple. When you send a text message, where does it go? Honestly, if you're thinking about me, I'm just thinking that the message is traveling through the air. But, and yes, it is actually for a moment, but what it does is from your phone to nearby cell tower. But after that, it enters a network of cables, massive cables that carry data as pulses of light. Yeah, the internet runs on light. Fiber optic cables are made of ultra pure glass, thinner than a human hair. Inside each strand, data travels as pulses of laser light. These pulses bounce internally along the glass core in a process called the total internal reflection. Because light travels incredibly fast, nearly 186,000 miles per second, information can move across continents almost instantly. And unlike traditional copper wires that transmit electrical signals, fiber optics can carry vastly more information with far less signal loss. This is not just an upgrade in speed, it's a transformation in capacity. One fiber optic cable can carry terabytes of data per second. That means millions of phone calls, thousands of HD video streams, financial transactions, research data, emergency communications, all moving simultaneously. But here's what's surprising. More than 95% of internet traffic does not travel by satellite. It travels through submarine cables on the ocean floor, stretching across thousands of miles. These submarine cables connect continents. There are hundreds of them, weaving a web between the oceans. Each cable is about the width of a garden hose, and yet inside of it inside of it are bundles of fiber strands, protected by layers of steel wiring, insulation, and waterproof shielding. Laying one of these cables is an enormous engineering operation. Specialized ships slowly unspool the cable into the sea, carefully mapping routes to avoid underwater mountains, volcanic zones, earthquake-prone regions. In shallow waters, the cables are sometimes buried beneath the seabed to protect them from fishing equipment and anchors. Once installed, these cables must operate reliably in crushing pressure, total darkness, and even extreme cold. And they do. The average submarine cable can last about 25 years, but they aren't indestructible. Every year, dozens of cable disruptions occur. Most are accidental: fishing trawlers, anchors dragging across the seabed. Some are caused by earthquakes, and occasionally, they raise geopolitical concerns. But here's something we don't talk about enough. The physical layout of submarine cables influence global power dynamics. Countries depend on stable connections to participate in global markets. Financial transactions rely on milliseconds of speed. Cloud computing depends on low latency connections. Internal diplomacy and defense systems rely on secure data transfer. So if a major cable is like severed, entire regions can experience slowdowns, outages, and so much more. And yes, the internet is global, but it is also very fragile. And that fragility reveals something important. We think of the internet as decentralized and kind of abstract because not many people understand the depths of it. But it has a physical backbone, which is highly concentrated in specific landing points, coastal cities where cables come ashore. Places like New York, Miami, Singapore, and Mumbai act as critical hubs. These landing stations are some of the most strategically important buildings in the world, even though most people have never heard of these buildings. Inside them, data is routed, amplified, and distributed inland. And amplification is key, because while light travels fast, it still weakens over distance. So along submarine cables, engineers install repeaters. I believe these devices are placed every 50 to 100 kilometers. But that boosts the light signal so it can continue across oceans. These repeaters operate under immense pressure, and most function flawlessly for decades. Like, these devices are sitting miles beneath the ocean surface, amplifying internet traffic 24 hours a day, year after year, unseen, unheard. But is the now in a technological world, it is the most essential thing. This is what infrastructure looks in the digital age, and it like forces us to rethink about what we see as a simple message, and it can be seen, a simple message can be seen as the speed of light going through a cable. It really solidifies our understanding. But there's nothing virtual about the labor, materials, energy required to sustain it. Fiber optic cables are manufactured in specialized facilities where glass is heated to extreme temperatures and drawn into thin strands. These strands must be perfectly pure. Any imperfection can scatter light and reduce signal strength. We also calculate refractive indices, signal dispersion, bandwidth capacities, and transmission efficiencies. On top of that, another invisible worker to this global internet thing is data centers. connected directly into these fiber networks, massive warehouse-sized buildings filled with servers, which store the information we casually upload, like photos, documents, videos, conversations, even our personal information. When you upload the file to the cloud, it just doesn't just appear there. It travels through fiber, across routers, into a server rack, into another building, and then cooled by industrial air systems powered by enormous electrical grids. The internet is physical and it consumes energy. Global data transmission requires significant electricity. As streaming increases, as remote work expands, and as digital economies grow, the demand for faster and more robust fiber infrastructure rises. This is why new submarine cables are constantly being built. Technology companies, telecommunication firms, and even governments invest billions into expanding cable networks. But why? Because speed is power. Financial markets measure latency in milliseconds. A faster cable route between trading hubs can translate into enormous competitive advantage. The design of cables can influence economic relationships between countries. And infrastructure becomes strategy at one point. But beyond all this, there's something more. Fiber optics have changed how we can experience distance. Before submarine cables and all the transatlantic communication and telegraph wires, messages were slow and expensive. Voice communication across oceans was never too limited. But now video calls happen instantly. Families separated by continents see each other in real time. Business collaboration happens globally. Research teams share massive data sets across borders. The compression of distance is not magic. It is just glass and light. Well, it's simply not just glass and light, but it's a lot more. But it's really, if you look at it from the basics, it is glass and light. And that achievement quietly reshapes our culture into a more digitalized society. It enables remote education, it supports telemedicine, it allows for creative collaboration across time zones. But on top of that, it also supports misinformation, surveillance, and cyber conflict. But that's why understanding how physical internet matters, because when we don't see infrastructure, we stop questioning it. We assume constant connectivity is inevitable. That's a hard word. But it is built, maintained, repaired. So there's also like a growing conversation about cable security. As global tensions shift, countries are paying more attention to who owns this cable infrastructure. Historically, telecommunication companies led submarine cable projects. Today, major technology corporations co-invest in them, seeking faster and more direct control over data flow. Ownership influences routing. Routing influences speed, and speed influences market. It's a chain reaction. And we are continuing to push the limits of fiber capacity and so much more. Through techniques like wavelength division multiplexing, multiple light wavelengths, essentially different colors of laser light, are sent simultaneously through the same fiber strand, dramatically increasing capacity. Now that word, wavelength division multiplexing, that's a big word. But basically what it's saying is that instead of putting one wavelength through a cable, we're putting in multiple. So it's kind of like when you're playing laser tag and you have like five people trying to get one person. It's like a different, it's like five or six amount of essentially laser tags. But as the demand for data grows from streaming, gaming, cloud storage, and emerging technologies, fiber optics remain the backbone. Even wireless technologies rely on fiber. 5G towers, Wi-Fi networks, cellular systems ultimately connect back into wired fiber systems. wireless is the last mile, but fiber is the highway to all of this. The more wireless our world becomes, the more wired it actually is. Which is a crazy thing, because everybody thinks that, oh, if it's like wireless, like you would assume that, like, you know, there would be less wires, but it actually just makes it more wires. Like, if I go from wired headphones to like wireless headphones, then I don't see a wire, but now it's actually increasing the wires because we need more fiber optics to travel that data. So modern life rests on these systems, and we rarely acknowledge them. Honestly, internet feels seamless because the fiber optics kind of absorb that complexity. It feels instant because infrastructure relies on this. Infrastructure is what makes it seamless. And it feels immaterial because this glass carries light beneath the oceans. And of course, we're not going to see that. Technology is not just devices in our hands. It is cables beneath our feet. It is repeaters in the dark. It's landing stations at coastlines. It's science transformed into communication. And understanding that makes us more informed participants in the digital world. Because when we recognize that the internet is infrastructure and it's not something that just comes to us, it helps us ask better questions and it helps us understand what new technologies will do and how will it impact our environment. So before we go on a little music break, I'm just going to give a quick PSA. Does your organization or nonprofit have an upcoming fundraiser or special event here in our community? Are you part of an upcoming charity music concert or a special art event? How about a workshop or educational seminar? WEFT has many public affairs programs and would love to have you on the show as a special guest to tell the community all about your upcoming event. To learn more, send an email with the details at psa@weft.org or call WEFT at 217-359-9338. So we're just going to go on a quick music break. And I will talk to you on the next section. So you're listening on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Have a good day. Hello, you are on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. This is her host, Irvi Banerjee. And on the last segment of this talk, we talked about the hidden physical systems that carry information across oceans, fiber optic cables, submarine infrastructure, the invisible architecture of connection. But there's something even more fundamental than data. Before information can move, before devices can function, and before networks can light up, there must be power. Electricity is so constant in our lives that we don't really stop to think about it. You flip a switch, the light turns on. You plug in a device, it charges. You power a subway, a hospital, a restaurant, and it works. But electricity is not just there. It is generated, transformed, transmitted, balanced, controlled through one of the most complex systems ever built, the electrical grid. And like the internet cables beneath the sea, the power grid is largely invisible. And it is the foundation of modern civilization. Without it, a lot of things don't function. The modern electrical grid began in the late 19th century, when inventors and engineers began experimenting with large-scale power generation. The challenge was not producing electricity, it was distributing it safely and efficiently across long distance. even early system used direct current or DC. But DC had major limitation. It could not travel very far without losing sufficient energy. That meant power plants had to be located very close to where electricity was used. The breakthrough came with alternating current, AC. Alternating current allows inventors to use transformers to increase voltage for long-distance transmission and then decrease it for safe use in homes and businesses. High voltage reduces energy loss during transmission. This was the key to building regional and eventually national grids. And that's what the power grid is, a massive network of generation stations, transmission lines, substations, transformers, and distributing systems. So electricity begins at a power plant. That plant might be powered by natural gas, coal, nuclear reactors, hydroelectric dams, wind turbines, or solar farms. Regardless of the source, the principle is similar. Energy is used to spin a turbine, and that turbine turns a generator. A generator converts this mechanical motion into electrical energy using electromagnetic induction. As coils of the wire spin, they produce an alternating current. But the electricity generated at the plant is not yet ready for homes. First, it is sent to a transformer that increases the voltage dramatically. Sometimes it's hundreds of thousands of volts. High voltage allows electricity to travel long distances through transmission lines with minimal loss. Those towering metal structures you see along highways, these are transmission towers carrying high voltage lines across cities, states, and countries. The electricity flows through these lines to substations, where transformers reduce the voltage step by step. Eventually, the electricity reaches local distribution lines, the smaller wires you see running between poles in neighborhoods. And finally, it reaches your home at a safe voltage level. That entire journey from a spinning turbine to your light switch happens in seconds. But here's where it becomes more fascinating. Electricity must be balanced in real time. Unlike data, electricity cannot be stored easily at large scale. The amount generated must be closely matched the amount being used, constantly. If too much electricity is produced, frequency increases. And if too little is produced, frequency drops. Either imbalance can damage equipment or cause outages. In the U.S., the grid operates at a frequency of about 60 hertz. In many other countries, it operates at 50 hertz. Grid operators continuously monitor and adjust the hertz to keep that frequency stable. This requires immense coordination. Power plants ramp up or down output based on demand. Control centers monitor grid performances 24 hours a day. Automated systems adjust flows. People model demand patterns based on weather, time of day, and seasonal behavior. On a hot summer afternoon when millions of air conditioners turn on simultaneously, demand spikes. The grid must respond immediately. If it doesn't, blackouts happen, and blackouts reveal just how dependent we are on electricity. Hospitals switch to backup generators, traffic lights fail, water treatment plants pause, refrigeration systems shut down, communication networks weaken. The grid is not optional, it's the lifeline of cities. But building and maintaining the grid is one of the most complex challenges that's ever been created. Transmission lines must withstand extreme weather, heat, wind, ice, lightning. Substations must be protected against overload. Equipment must be upgraded regularly. And increasing the grid must integrate renewable energy sources. solar and wind power introduce variability. The sun does not always shine, the wind does not always blow. That means grid engineers must adapt to fluctuating supply. This is where grid modernization comes in. Smart grid technology incorporates sensors, automation, and advanced monitoring systems to power the network. These sensors detect outages instantly, reroute electricity when lines fail, and allow utilities to respond more quickly. Rather than waiting for customers to report outages, systems can identify problems automatically. Another major development is battery storage. While electricity is difficult to store, advances in large-scale battery systems allows for renewable energy to be stored temporarily and released when needed. Utility-scale batteries help smooth out supply fluctuations and support grid stability. And on top of that, microgrids are also emerging. A microgrid is a smaller, localized grid that can operate independently. If the main grid fails, universities, hospitals, and military bases sometimes use microgrids to maintain power during outages. This decentralization actually increases our resilience, and resilience is becoming very critical, especially during times of outages, blackouts, and things that we cannot control, but we still need to continue. Extreme weather events are increasing strain on power infrastructure. Hurricanes can knock out transmission lines. Wildfires can damage substations. Ice storms can bring down poles. And now people are redesigning systems with climate resilience in mind. They're burying lines underground, reinforcing towers, using predictive analytics to anticipate failures. But beyond that, there's also a social aspect to it. Access to reliable electricity is deeply tied to so many things. Regions without stable grids struggle to support industry, healthcare, education, and connectivity to other nations and other people. Energy infrastructure is developing. In many parts of the world, electrification transformed daily life. Lighting extended productive hours, refrigeration improved food safety, water pumping systems supported agriculture, telecommunications became possible. Electricity reshapes societies, and yet we rarely think about it. But it's not something that's bad necessarily. It's something that we need to understand how reliant we truly are with these power grids and micro power grids, making sure that places of need, such as hospitals and other places, they need to have electricity especially to help people, to help patients. And there's so much more to it. Like, power grids are national assets. They are regulated, protected, and monitored closely. Cybersecurity for grid infrastructure has become a major priority. As grids incorporate digital control systems, protecting them from intrusion becomes absolutely critical. An attack on the grid is not just a technical disruption, it's a societal one. And I know we're looking into what bad might happen if, you know, we don't get electricity and we don't see the things, but let's see one of the most remarkable things about this grid and its synchronization to the world. Across vast regions, thousands of generators operate in phase with one another, and they must rotate in precise coordination to maintain frequency stability. It's like, imagine if multiple orchestras played the same note across hundreds of miles perfectly timed. That is what synchronization is, and that's what generators do. If one falls out of sync, like one player doesn't play the right note, it can destabilize the network. And people are inventing sophisticated control systems to maintain the balance. There are also high voltage direct current lines, or as we call it, HVDC systems, used for very long distance transmission or underwater cables, like we talked about before. HVDC reduces energy losses over extremely long routes and allows connections between grids operating at different frequencies. This means grids can interconnect internationally, sharing power across borders. Interconnection improves reliability, and if one region experiences shortage, another can supply electricity. But it also increases complexity. The grid is not a single machine, it's a constantly adapting system that we all rely on. And the most fascinating thing is that this is one of the only machines that humans have built that operates at a continental scale in real time. Like right now, the power grid is working and we made it. We made a continental thing that crosses from here to the other side of the world, and it never shuts off. It has no pause button. It has to work continuously. And when we think of modern technology, we kind of think about it as, oh, someone made something like a phone or a TV or something like that. But just imagining it not as just a phone or just a machine, but in continuous system that we built that goes across oceans and goes under oceans, like it goes under our feet. It's we see it every single day, and it's something that's so amazing, and I don't think a lot of people like are grateful for such an amazing thing that we have. So you are listening on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and we are going to go on a quick music break. But I'm your host, Irvi Banerjee, and I will see you soon. Hello, welcome back. This is your host, Irvi Banerjee, and you are on Tech Unfiltered on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and you can stream online at weft.org. Before we get back into it, I have to do a quick PSA. The McLean County Arts Center invites nonprofit organizations to apply for the 2026 Regional Arts Partners Grant. The grants will support outward-facing artists, cultural programming completed by August 1st, 2026, and support community-driven art initiatives in partnership with the Illinois Art Council. The application for this deadline in the grant is Friday, February 13th, 2026. And for more information, please contact mcac.org. Welcome back, everybody. And just on the latest segment, we talked about these amazing electricity-powered grids. But just like any other thing, one of the biggest things that we need to live, and we cannot live actually without more than 3 days, I believe, is water. Everybody needs water. Every human being needs water. Every animal needs water. Everyone needs water. But when you turn on a faucet, do you think about the machines helping that work? The mountains that the water has to come from, the underground pumping stations, the chemical treatment facility balancing the water to make sure your water is healthy? Most likely not, because I definitely do not. For me, I am grateful just to expect clean water. But clean water on demand is not natural. It is machines working. For most of human history, people lived near their water source, rivers, lakes, wells, and those determined settlement patterns. Those determined whether settlement would be successful. And water had to be carried manually. Waste had to be accumulated nearby, and with that, disease spread easily. The transformation began when people learned to move water at scale. One of the earliest breakthroughs was the development of aqueduct systems, structures that transported water over long distances, usually carefully calculated slopes. Gravity did the work, but geometry made it possible. Modern cities will rely on that principle. Water begins its journey at a source, often a reservoir, a lake, or a river. In many cases, that water has traveled through mountain watersheds before being captured by dams. These dams do more than store water. They regulate flow, prevent flooding, and create pressure potential. From that reservoir, water enters massive intake structures. Screens filter out debris, branches, sediment, organic matter, and then the water moves to a treatment plant. And that is where a lot of chemistry is involved, where raw water contains microorganisms, suspended particles, dissolved minerals, and sometimes pollutants. To make it safe for human consumption, it undergoes several stages. First is coagulation, and then flocculation, and then chemicals are added to cause tiny particles to clump together in large masses called flock, and this makes them easier to move. Now, it doesn't really matter what coagulation means or flocculation means. I don't think we really need to know what that means, but basically, the thing is here is that chemicals are being added to for these tiny particles to clump up, and so that we can get clean water. And then next comes sedimentation. The heavy flock settles to the bottom of large tanks, and then filtration. Water passes through layers of sand, gravel, and sometimes activated carbon, removing smaller particles and impurities. Now, finally, after all of that, it's disinfection. Chlorine, ozone, or ultraviolet light is used to eliminate harmful pathogens. The result is water safe to drink. But that process doesn't stop there. The water must be transported across regions. And here's where pressure becomes crucial. Water does not magically climb buildings. It moves through pipes because of pressure gradients. And people use a combination of gravity and pumping stations to maintain consistent pressure throughout the distribution network. Water towers are not decorative landmarks. They are pressure regulators. Elevated storage tanks create gravitational force that pushes water through pipes evenly. They stabilize supply during peak demand and provide emergency reserves during outages. Beneath every major city lies a ton of pipes, some decades old and some even over a century. And large transmission carries the water from treatment plants to neighborhoods, and smaller distribution pipes branch into streets. And even smaller service lines connect to every single home, and maybe, indefinitely, actually, including yours. So this network must maintain constant monitoring. A single rupture can flood streets, disrupt supply, and damage infrastructure. Maintenance crews monitor these pressure levels and detect leaks against acoustic sensors, and repair aging lines before catastrophic failure. But what's equally complex is what happens after we use that water. Once water leaves your sink, shower, or washing machine, it enters the wastewater system. Gravity is again the primary force. Sewage flows downhill through the sloped pipes toward larger sewer mains. In flat cities, pumping stations, which lift the wastewater so it can continue flowing by gravity again, and eventually it reaches a wastewater treatment facility. And this is where biology comes in. Wastewater treatments use physical, chemical, and biological processes to remove contaminants before releasing water back into the environment. The first stage is screening, removing large debris. Then, primarily settling tanks, allowing the solids to sink to the bottom, forming sludge. But the most fascinating stage is actually the secondary treatment. Here, microorganisms are intentionally introduced into aeration tanks. These bacteria consume organic waste in the water, and air is pumped into the tanks to support metabolism. It's mostly controlled by ecology. And these engineered ecosystems are designed to digest waste. And after the biological treatment, the water undergoes further clarification and often disinfection before being released into rivers or oceans. And it's really interesting how we, that in order for it to digest waste, we basically make an ecosystem within the water for those organisms to actually eat the waste, which is crazy that you're making a whole ecosystem within just a tank. And the sludge removed during this treatment is processed and sometimes converted into fertilizer. The entire cycle from a reservoir to a tap to a drain to a river is managed continuously. And just like electricity, it cannot pause, and water demands fluctuates daily. There's morning peaks, evening surges, seasonal variation, industrial uses. And this predictive modeling is to forecast demand, monitor system pressures, and prevent contamination events. And one of the most remarkable aspects of water infrastructure is actually its longevity. Some systems rely on these pipes that are from like the 19th century to replace them from these excavation beneath roads, coordination with other buried utilities, and enormous financial investments. Water systems are very expensive, but it's something that we all rely on, and it's all based upon a machine, and it's all based upon what humans made. So that is all on Tech Unfiltered. I'm your host, Irvi Vanerjee, and you're listening on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I hope everybody has an amazing day, and I will see you next week.